This podcast contains coarse language, dark humor, descriptions of violence, and controversial opinions. Listener discretion is advised. Well, hello there, podcast listener. I'll keep this short and sweet this time. Please show me some love, subscribe wherever you found me, and share my murder stories on your internet. Word of mouth is the best advertisement. Much love to all of you. A few episodes ago, I talked about a few of the last people to be executed in states where capital punishment has been abolished. Currently, there are 27 states that still have the death penalty. Of those 27, there are 5 who have executions scheduled for this year. As I mentioned in the Ohio episode, and probably 100 other times at least, they are the state with the most scheduled executions, all the way out to 2027. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to execute everyone on the list. 2 of those men were featured in Sword and Scale episodes. James Worley has a date in 2025, and George Brinkman Jr. has one in 2026. As I've covered the news in my live streams, I've become more aware of what must go through the minds of the condemned as they face their end. Utah doesn't execute women, so as long as I stay here, I can lose my shit and nothing will happen to me. It's all jokes. For hell's sake, I have way too much to lose to do a crime worthy of prison time. Every time someone's execution date rolls around and I talk about it, I am forced to think about their final moments. Their last meals as well, more often than not. Do these people actually feel remorse for their crimes? Do they go into the death chamber and cry tears of actual grief for their actions? Or do they pull a Donald Dilbeck and leave this world full of bitterness, blaming the governor for signing their death warrant? Creating this podcast and doing all the research I do has kind of forced me to think about the finality of death. These condemned prisoners have been sitting in a cage for up to 40 years, waiting for the state to kill them. I can't imagine what it must be like in those final weeks, running the clock out, running the appeals out, throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks and see if they can get another chance to be spared. They're here today, gone tomorrow. Most of us don't even think about them because we're fortunate enough to not be directly affected by their actions. Today's episode more than likely won't have a last meal. There's a small chance it will, but don't count on it. I can't predict the future. Today, we're looking at some of the next men who are in line to die at the hands of the state. I've decided to tell these stories starting with the one furthest away from execution. The great state of Ohio has some truly fucked up people in it, including the 2 I mentioned a minute ago that are mentioned on Sword and Scale. There is a reason they've got executions scheduled out so far. They kinda need to. The Midwest is full of all kinds of horrible criminals who deserve to be put down. Crimes against the elderly set me off. If you've been here before, you already know that. There's been a case of some violent psychopath killing an old person in just about every episode I've done so far. Harold White Sr. was an 84-year-old man living alone in Chillicothe. On September 19th, 1985, he left his apartment to go get dinner at a nearby restaurant. Sometime around 9:15 or 9:30 that night, Harold returned home and found 2 burglars inside his house. One of them was rifling through drawers in the kitchen. Harold pointed a flashlight at him and asked, "What the hell are you doing in my apartment? I'm going to get all the money and stuff I can." Harold then told the man to get out or he was going to call the cops. The balls on this man! God damn, I hope to have such a strong will if I live to be 84. While Harold was arguing with the strange man, later identified as 23-year-old Lawrence Landrum, another person came up behind Harold and struck him in the head several times with a railroad bolt. This accomplice was a 14-year-old boy named Grant Swackhammer. After Harold hit the floor, Swackhammer continued to beat him for a few more minutes. Landrum sat next to Harold and continued wrestling with him. This resulted in the surgical gloves he was wearing being torn. Landrum told his young accomplice that Harold was still alive and to go grab him a large kitchen knife. What exactly happened next has been disputed, as Landrum has given a few different versions of the events, but another witness called to testify paints a pretty fucked up picture. Karen Brown, who was 16 at the time of the crime, testified that Landrum had told her about Harold's murder. She claimed that he'd confessed to breaking into Harold's house with Swackhammer, and that they'd been planning it for a few days. Swackhammer was the one who beat the elderly man with the railroad bolt, and Landrum had finished him off by slashing his throat. Harold's autopsy showed multiple blunt force injuries to the head. One of these was a depressed skull fracture that could have been fatal on its own. The cause of death was a gaping neck wound, 5 inches long and deep enough to hit the spine. His neck was slashed 2 separate times. His windpipe was severed. Karen later went with Landrum to the same apartment building Harold lived in, to a unit on the first floor. Landrum told her, "Oh, by the way, there's a dead body above you." He also asked her what she'd do if blood dripped down from the ceiling and landed on her. And then, like any good gentleman, asked if she wanted to go upstairs and see the body. Later on that evening, Landrum threatened Karen and a group of other teenagers that he'd slit their throats if they told anyone about what he'd done. He said that he'd sliced one person's throat, so he'd slice another. Police went to Harold's apartment on September 20th after receiving an anonymous phone call. Inside, they found the man lying with a gaping hole in his neck and blood pooled all around him. The apartment had been ransacked. Drawers were dumped out, closet doors were left open, and a locked cabinet appeared to have been pried open. In addition to this, 2 pieces of material were found that were later determined to be bits of surgical gloves. Landrum was arrested on September 21st. He'd bought a one-way ticket to Michigan the day before and had every intention of getting the fuck out of Ohio. A search conducted on September 23rd found a large kitchen knife in the woods, along with a paper bag containing a bloody towel, Harold's wallet, rubber gloves, and a pair of surgical gloves. These gloves matched the fragments they'd found in Harold's apartment. Other evidence presented at trial proved that this hadn't been a random attack. Landrum had indeed been planning this for days. Carolyn Brown was Harold's downstairs neighbor and a friend of Lawrence Landrum. She testified that on September 17th, the man had told her that he was in trouble and needed some money. He also told her that he was thinking about robbing Harold. She asked him, "What if you rob him and he comes in on you?" "I'll kill him." In his own testimony, Landrum claimed that he'd told Carolyn he only intended to knock Harold unconscious. Obviously, a lie to cover his own ass at trial. Landrum also told Carolyn that he'd be wearing surgical gloves so that he wouldn't leave any fingerprints behind. The planning that went into this, it makes me sick. Landrum went upstairs on September 18th to get a better look at Harold's apartment. He knocked on the man's door and told him he was looking for an apartment to rent. Harold, being elderly and probably just wanting to help out how he could, allowed Landrum to walk through his apartment and check it out. Quick side story. I had something similar to this happen to me a few years ago. I had come home from taking my kids somewhere, and there were 2 men standing by the entrance to my apartment building when we got out of the car. They asked if I lived there, and I immediately went into fight or flight mode, like I do. I said yes, and then shielded my kids from them. They asked if they could come in and see my apartment, and I said, hell no. This led to these 2 random men checking the windows of the bottom floor apartments until the manager called the cops. Could have gone so wrong. Don't let strangers into your house. Lawrence Alfred Landrum is scheduled to be executed on October 15th, 2024. In a 1999 appeal, Landrum tried to blame his substance abuse and rough childhood for what had happened to Harold. I don't know how many times I need to say it, but those things are not an excuse to murder an old man. If you don't think that's ridiculous enough on its own, Landrum blamed the court system for not being effective in keeping him on the straight and narrow path, as if he had no part in his own actions. Ohio hasn't executed anyone since 2018 due to issues obtaining lethal injection drugs. Landrum is the next one on their list. He was initially scheduled to be put down on February 12th of 2020, but due to last-minute appeals and the inability to get the proper drugs, his date was pushed back more than 4 years. Oh, And I can't find Grant Swaghammer in the system. I'm assuming he got off easy due to his age. Last week, I joked about Oklahoma executing people for sport, but I really should have saved that joke for when we get to Texas. They lead the nation in executions, so much that Family Guy has taken several stabs at them. No pun intended. When a teenage girl goes missing, hell, when anyone goes missing, you look at the spouse first. The husband, the boyfriend, the random guy she met on the internet that she's been texting nonstop. You never assume it's random. Bridget Townsend was a 16-year-old girl living in Bandera County, Texas in 2001. Her boyfriend, Joe, was a drug dealer. This is where the case ends, right? I haven't even told you what happened, and I'm sure you want to draw a conclusion. Joe last heard from Bridget around 7 p.m. on January 14th, 2001. This was a bit unusual, so he began calling her friends and family. They hadn't heard from her either. There was only one person left who might have seen Bridget, Ramiro Gonzalez. This man was a friend of Joe's who had allegedly stopped by Joe's house looking for him earlier that day. Bridget was the only one home at the time. Drug dealers don't usually hang out with the most productive members of society. Trust me, I would know. I've seen the side of the criminal underground that a lot of you probably never have. I'm gonna spoil the end a little bit here. Joe was not at all responsible for his girlfriend's disappearance. His career choice had nothing to do with it either. Ramiro Gonzalez was an unsavory character. In 2003, he pled guilty to the kidnapping and rape of a Bandera County real estate agent. Texas doesn't fuck around, in case you weren't aware, and he was given life in prison for these crimes. He later tried to appeal this, claiming that there was new evidence that should grant him a new trial. This evidence was just hearsay. The appeals court wasn't having it, and Gonzalez was not given a new trial. Maybe this was why he decided to contact the sheriff while waiting to be transferred to his concrete box of permanent residence. Gonzalez told the sheriff that he knew what had happened to Bridget Townsend. He was the one who'd killed her. Sheriff McMillan didn't believe him at first, but Gonzalez told him that he could take him to her remains. He even described what she was wearing when he shot her to death. A ranch in Medina County was searched 2 years after Bridget went missing. She was found on a remote hillside, with the same jewelry Gonzalez had described. Pretty fucking cut and dry case right here, not much to argue in court. Like I said earlier, drug dealers tend to hang out with some pretty shady fucking people. Gonzalez went to his friend Joe's house to get some cocaine. Bridget informed him that Joe wasn't home, and he decided to take advantage of the situation. He could easily get into the house and steal either money or drugs. What was Bridget gonna do? She was all alone. Gonzalez came back and knocked on the door again. Bridget answered, and he barged inside. He wasn't able to find any cocaine, but there was a bit of money laying around. Bridget didn't know what to do, so she tried calling Joe for help. Gonzalez reacted to this by pushing her down and restraining her before throwing her into his truck and driving toward the ranch where she'd later be found. On the way to the ranch, he stopped and got a rifle from his grandfather. Bridget didn't want to die. She tried to offer him money, drugs, and even sex in exchange for her life. Unfortunately for her, Gonzalez wasn't in a bargaining mood. He raped her before walking her out towards some brush and shooting her. After he was done, he headed back to his grandparents' house to put the rifle away in his grandfather's truck. This monster confessed to what he'd done and was convicted in 2006. He said in a later interview that he decided to confess because Bridget's mom deserved to know the truth. There is good in almost everyone, but that good doesn't always outweigh the evil. Ramiro Felix Gonzalez is scheduled to be executed on June 26, 2024. His execution has been delayed several times already, for a number of reasons. COVID, of course, because that put literally everything on hold. Religious accommodations were also an issue. The condemned love to use that as a reason their lives should be spared. I've talked about this at length on my streams. Gonzalez even went so far as to offer to donate a kidney to delay his execution. I can't remember which episode it was, but I talked about another man who tried doing this exact thing. It's almost admirable until you realize they're only doing it to prolong their time on Earth. They don't actually care about other people. If they did, they wouldn't have done a crime that landed them a death sentence. The most recent appeal includes the new testimony of the forensic psychologist who testified that Gonzalez would likely commit sex crimes again and was a danger to the public. I mean, he'd already pled guilty to rape and been charged with it a second time. Probably a pretty solid opinion right there. But this doctor interviewed Gonzalez years later and changed his opinion, saying that his sentence should be reduced to life in prison. I guess we'll see where this goes. His case is being sent back to court to determine if his sentence should be commuted. After I decided to end my marriage, I had an odd realization about the handful of men who were in my life at the time. All of them were married. And before you go getting your panties in a bunch thinking I'm a homewrecker, I was only interested in one of them, and he was separating from his wife. I had nothing to be ashamed of. One was an old friend, another was a dude I met online while trying to remember how to be a human and have social interactions. Why do I attract married men? I mean, a line I've been laughing at for a couple weeks now is, we have to get divorced so we can get married. It's obviously too soon to even think about another wedding, but it's still hilarious. This next case validates a paranoia I had about getting back into the dating pool. It's fucked. Angela Gilpin and her husband were going through some shit. It happens, I know all too well. The couple separated and she started seeing a man named David Hozier. This relationship was going fine until Angela decided to reconcile with her husband. Word of advice, don't. You separated for a reason. That reason isn't just going to magically go away because you love each other. Move out and move on. Dumping my ex was the best decision I've made in a long time. Hozier had a lot of weapons, according to an application for a protective order Angela had in her purse. After she broke things off with him, he began stalking and harassing her. This kind of shit is why I'm a firm believer in everyone carrying a gun. My ex probably wants me dead. Can't say I blame him there, honestly, but he knows better than to try anything because I will shoot his ass if he does. Fuck around and find out, you know? In September of 2009, the bodies of Angela and her husband Rodney were found outside their apartment in Jefferson City, Missouri. Both of them had been shot with 9mm bullets. Shell casings were found in the hallway as well as the apartment itself. Angela's purse was found to contain that application for a protective order against Hozier. He was the most obvious suspect right out of the gate. Many witnesses came forward to tell police that Hozier had been threatening Angela and stalking her. He'd even left threatening messages on her neighbor's cell phone. Police got a search warrant for Hozier's apartment, where they found some 9mm ammunition, an empty box of 9mm shells, and the schematic for a 9mm machine gun. In addition to the search warrant, police also obtained a ping order to track Hozier's cell phone. They used this to determine that he was heading south through Oklahoma. A local officer spotted his car and tried to pull him over, but he led them on a chase before finally giving up. As he stepped out of the car, he told them, "Shoot me and get it over with." When he was arrested, police found many incriminating items, including a knife, a bulletproof vest, and 15 guns. One of which was later determined to be the murder weapon. It was the one he had the schematic for. Hozier was charged with a bunch of shit, but Angela's murder was the big one. He was found guilty on all counts and received a death sentence. David Russell Hozier is scheduled to be executed on June 11th, 2024. He tried to appeal his conviction on the grounds that the ping order on his phone violated his Fourth Amendment right. That's the one about unreasonable searches and seizures. Not sure how a ping order on a man who was a clear threat to this woman is unreasonable, but y'all know how condemned criminals think. Throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. Any technicality to get out of a death sentence, even if you stalked and murdered your ex-girlfriend because she went back to her husband. Over the last year, I've looked into hundreds of capital cases. What I expect to see are rapes, crimes against children, and serial killers. You know, the really heinous shit. It's always surprising to me when I find a state whose condemned are mostly guilty of murder during the course of a robbery. Happens a lot more than you'd think. Wade and Chris Lay were bonding as father and son, respectively, in May of 2004. Not fishing, not rebuilding a car, hell, not even kicking back and watching TV. They were robbing a bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma. For God's sake, are we really back in the Sooner State? These two men entered the Mid-First Bank wearing ski masks and gloves, armed with guns. Chris immediately told a bank employee to get on the ground. This got the attention of a security guard, who jumped into action to try and prevent this robbery. A shootout ensued, and the security guard was killed. The Lays managed to get away, but did so without getting any of the cash. They were both arrested a short time later. What makes this one interesting is not the crime itself. That was just a cold, heartless murder in the name of easy money. Y'all know how much I hate the government. Wade Lay was the same. He wanted to avenge the deaths of the Branch Davidians. Gonna do a whole episode on Waco one of these days, probably for anyone who decides to pay for premium content. It's a hell of a story. Wade wanted to start a revolution and stand in the face of tyranny. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I can think of a million other ways to avenge the deaths of those murdered by the government that don't include shooting an innocent man. Both father and son were tried together in September of 2005. Chris was represented by an attorney while Wade decided to represent himself. Both men admitted guilt and claimed that they needed the money to fund their patriotic revolution. I hate the fucking government too, but there are better ways. Wade and Chris were both found guilty of first-degree murder and attempted robbery with a firearm. Chris walked away with a life sentence while his father was given death. Wade Greeley Lay is scheduled to be executed on June 6, 2024. His execution has already been stayed a handful of times. He was set to be put down on January 6, 2021, which you may already be aware is the day that the biggest tragedy in American history occurred. That's obviously sarcasm in case I didn't lay that on thick enough. Lay's execution was stayed so that a jury could decide if he was competent enough to be executed. He is a delusional man who believes in conspiracies and aliens. Honestly, my kind of guy had he not shot an innocent man to death while robbing a bank. Lay believes that the courts are conspiring with his attorneys to silence his views on how the government should be. He told the public defender appointed to him that he believes in a shadow government and that an alien disguised as Satan had infiltrated the government. I hate to be this guy, but he might have a point. It just hit me that two of the last three cases have been robberies gone wrong. Really didn't intend that. There are much worse things a person could do to get the death penalty, but I guess the US really hates theft unless it's the government stealing from the citizens. Alabama has a metric fuckton of botched executions. Maybe soon they'll be adding another one to that list. Floyd and Vera Hill were living out their twilight years in Gwynn, Alabama. The elderly couple had been married for 55 years. Floyd, who was 87 at the time, took care of his 72-year-old wife. Vera was diabetic and in very poor health and needed round-the-clock care. This is the type of love I hope to have. Still too early in the relationship to tell if he'll take care of me when I'm old and broken, but I hope so. Floyd took excellent care of his wife, setting alarms to ensure she got her medications on time and tending to her every need. The Hills were known to have frequent yard sales to help stay busy. Floyd often carried large amounts of cash around with him, which was noticed by some of the employees at the gas station he went to. One of these employees was a man named Jamie Mills. On the afternoon of June 24th, 2004, Mills and his wife Joanne showed up at Floyd and Vera's house with the intent to rob the couple. The then 30-year-old man was no longer working at the gas station and was looking for easy money. what he did to Floyd and Vera? Holy shit, you're gonna want to inject him yourself. Just after dark on that same day, one of the Hills' granddaughters began calling to check in on them. There was no answer, so she went to their house. Though it appeared they were home, no one came to answer the door. This is when she called the police to do a welfare check. Normally, calls like this aren't responded to immediately. It's not necessarily an emergency situation. For whatever reason, the Gwynn Police Department sent an officer out immediately, and he arrived in less than 5 minutes. Officer Larry Webb was told that the couple had last been heard from just after 2 p.m. that day. It was now dark outside, and the family was worried. Officer Webb tried calling the Hills from his cell phone and could hear their phone ringing inside. Vera's medication alarms were also going off. Something was clearly wrong. The officer made his way to the building where the Hills kept their yard sale items and climbed up to a point where he could see inside. Floyd was laying on his back in a pool of blood with a bloody towel over his face. Vera was on her side, just inside the door to the building. She was also covered in blood, but she was still alive. Her arm moved slightly as Officer Webb was looking at her. An ambulance was called, and the plastic door to the building was cut so that Officer Webb could render aid. It was clear that Floyd was already gone. He was cold and had no pulse. Vera was somehow still conscious. When asked what happened to her, all she could say was, "Let me out of here." A search of the Hills' house found that many items were missing. Floyd's wallet, Vera's purse, and the tackle box containing all of Vera's medications were gone. Their phone line had been cut as well. Floyd's autopsy showed that his cause of death was a combination of blunt and sharp force injuries to his head and neck. Vera pulled through, somehow. Her injuries included a depressed skull fracture on the back of her head, a broken neck, crushed hands, facial fractures, and multiple brain injuries. This woman was a fucking fighter. She was under hospice care at her daughter's house when she died from complications of blunt head trauma on September 12, 2004. On the night of the attacks, police interviewed several neighbors of the Hills, including their next-door neighbor Jennifer. She told them that she'd seen a white four-door sedan driving past her house several times that day. This same car was later spotted parked in the Hills' driveway. The police knew of a local man who drove a white car and decided to take a shot in the dark. A patrol unit was sent to the home of Jamie and Joanne Mills, but no one was there. It was decided that they should check back frequently to see if the couple would return to their house. This paid off in the end. At 9:45 on June 25th, police arrived to find their suspects attempting to leave in a white Nissan. The officers blocked them in and began questioning the couple. Jamie Mills was taken in for questioning while his wife remained behind and was interrogated by another investigator. Joanne made the dumb mistake of consenting to a search of her home and car. Inside the car, there was a green tackle box with a cut padlock on it. A large duffel bag that was splattered in blood was also found, along with the missing wallet and purse. Oh, and they found the murder weapons. A machete, a ball-peen hammer, and a wrench, all of which were covered in blood and hair. These items were later tested, and it was found that all the blood on them belonged to the Hills. Joanne and Jamie were both arrested that day, and Joanne would later testify against her husband, probably to avoid a death sentence, as if she would have gotten one anyway. At trial, Joanne told the court that she and her husband had been up smoking meth the night before the murders. On the evening of June 24th, they went out to run some errands, and Jamie decided that he needed to talk to a man about some money. He told his wife to follow his lead. At around 5:15 p.m., they arrived at Floyd and Vera's house and were let inside. Joanne sat and talked to them while Jamie attempted to make a few phone calls. Both couples sat and visited for a while before Vera decided she wanted to show Joanne some of the yard sale items she had stored. It was raining, so Floyd went outside first and unlocked the door before everyone else came out. Joanne and Vera talked for a minute before heading back inside. Floyd and Jamie remained in the shed. On the way back to the house, Joanne heard a loud noise and saw the silhouette of a man with something raised over his shoulder. It was her husband. The women went back to the shed to see what had happened and found Floyd laying on the ground. At this point, Joanne watched Jamie hit Vera in the head with a hammer. probably terrified, the young woman closed her eyes and stood still as her husband beat this elderly couple to a pulp with various items. Jamie put the towel over Floyd's head to muffle the gurgling sounds he was making. After padlocking the hills inside the shed, the couple went into the house to get the money and pills before heading back to their own residence. Joanne and Jamie were stopped on their way to go dispose of the murder weapons the next day. This was dumb luck. Had they gotten rid of the items on the night of the attacks, there's a chance they would have gotten away with it. Joanne Green Mills is currently serving a life sentence at the Birmingham Community Work Center. I have to assume she took a plea deal to avoid the death penalty, as she is not eligible for parole. However, you can write to her. She's looking for pen pals. According to CagedLadies.com, Joanne is a sweet, funny, down-to-earth country gal who's looking for someone to get to know. What a fucking world we live in. Jamie Ray Mills is scheduled to be executed on May 30th, 2024. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey just signed his death warrant a couple weeks ago, and Mills is scheduled to be put down via lethal injection. This came as a bit of a shock to me, as I was expecting him to be the second person to opt for a nitrogen execution. I guess not, though. An eye for an eye sounds better to me in this case. Maybe Alabama should authorize the use of a ball peen hammer and a machete. I will be keeping an eye on this one for sure, and will more than likely talk about it in an upcoming stream. He's set to be executed on a Thursday, so if you're curious what this Alabama psychopath has for his last meal, come hang out on Rumble or Odyssey that night. I started writing this last week, so at the time, the last person on my list of upcoming executions was still breathing. I told you we might get a last meal. I couldn't predict the future. Honestly, I kind of expected clemency for this one for some reason. Seems to me that some of the most fucked up criminals get clemency that they don't deserve. Just before Christmas in 2006, Sarah Bonney got a call from her cousin, Brian Dorsey, asking for money to pay off some drug dealers who were in his apartment. Sarah told her husband, Ben, what was going on, and he in turn called one of his friends and asked him to help get the men out. If I was in Dorsey's shoes, I would have been eternally grateful for the help. I've had some sketchy shit happen to me before, and my friends turned their backs on me when I asked for help. After the drug dealers left, Dorsey went back to his cousin's house for the night. Probably didn't want to be home after that mess, and I can't say I blame him. His idea of repayment for that favor, though? I'm not sure what drugs this dude was on, but I'm gonna take a wild guess and say meth. That night, Sarah and Ben and their friend Darren all played pool and drank some beers with Dorsey. A shotgun had been moved off the pool table prior to this. Dorsey drank a lot, and that's coming from me. 7 to 10 beers while everyone was still awake, and then part of a bottle of vodka after Darren went home. I have to imagine he was shit-faced. A little while after Ben and Sarah went to bed, Dorsey went to the garage and got the shotgun. He crept into the couple's bedroom and fatally shot Sarah in the jaw from about 12 inches away. The court documents aren't exactly clear on whether or not the shot woke Ben up, but Dorsey reloaded the gun, placed it against Ben's right ear, and then fired a second time. Ben died instantly. If you're wondering exactly what the fuck, don't worry, it gets even worse from here. After the couple died, Dorsey raped his cousin. Full-on raped her. Probably a good time to mention that this crime took place in Missouri. I'm sure you kind of assumed that, though. How could you not? After the murders and the post-mortem sexual assault, Dorsey added insult to injury by stealing Sarah's social security card and pouring bleach all over her body. He then left in Sarah's car and met up with a woman he had borrowed money from and needed to pay back. Dorsey tried to pay her with items he'd stolen from Ben and Sarah. I'm telling you, this crime has meth written all over it. I've had my share of interactions with tweakers, and this guy fucking strikes me as the most methed up man in the state of Missouri. Maybe he's from Cooter. Boy, that's a fucking callback, isn't it? Go listen to the Missouri episode if you haven't already. It's a good one. Dorsey was apparently heavily intoxicated as he drove around trying to sell some of the stolen goods, including the shotgun he'd used in the murders. On Christmas Eve, Sarah's parents decided to go check on the couple because they'd missed a family gathering. Once they got inside, they found Sarah's 4-year-old niece sitting on the couch watching TV. The little girl told her grandparents that she'd been trying all morning to wake Sarah up, but she won't wake up. Sarah's parents then tried knocking on the bedroom door but got no answer. It was locked, so Sarah's father broke it open and found a horrifying sight. Ben and Sarah were dead in their bed. DNA taken from Sarah's autopsy showed that a man other than her husband had deposited the sperm inside her. Further testing showed that it belonged to Brian Dorsey, her cousin. I'm gonna keep pointing this out until I'm done, because what in the actual fuck is going on in Missouri? The day after Christmas, Dorsey surrendered to the police and told them that he was the right guy concerning the deaths of Ben and Sarah. In his back pocket was Sarah's social security card. They had him dead to rights. Dorsey pled guilty to 2 counts of murder in 2008. I guess they didn't offer him a plea deal, though. He got 2 death sentences. Brian Joseph Dorsey was executed by lethal injection on April 9th, 2024. He was given a lethal dose of pentobarbital. No 3-drug cocktail, apparently. They're just overdosing motherfuckers with one thing now. His execution was relatively uneventful, and he went pretty peacefully. Dorsey's lawyers did what all defense attorneys do and argued against his execution, stating that it's a pointless cruelty, an exercise of the state's power that serves no legitimate penological purpose. Apparently, Dorsey had spent every day of the past 18 years trying to make up for the single act of violence he committed in 2006. Kinda hard to make up for shooting 2 innocent people in the head, raping one of them after she died, and then stealing from them. He got what was coming to him. Dorsey's last statement reads as follows. To all of the family and loved ones I share with Sarah, and to all of the surviving family and loved ones of Ben, I am truly, deeply, and overwhelmingly sorry. Words cannot hold the just weight of my guilt and shame. I still love you. I never wanted to hurt anyone. I am sorry I hurt them and you. To my family, friends, and all those that tried to prevent this, I love you. I'm grateful for you. I have peace in my heart in large part because of you, and I thank you. To all those on all sides of this sentence, I carry no ill will or anger, only acceptance and understanding. His last meal was 2 cheeseburgers, 2 large orders of fries, 2 orders of chicken strips, and a large pizza with sausage, onion, mushrooms, pepperoni, and extra cheese. My boyfriend asked me on stream a while back what I'd want my last meal to be. Basically that, minus the mushrooms, if I couldn't make the food myself. This one was a bit shorter than I wanted. I apologize for that. I usually try to find cases I know will grab your attention, but it was slim pickings this time. I just wanted to tell you about the people set to meet their maker in 2024. There is one more man set to be executed in December in Missouri, but his story didn't really get my attention. If you enjoyed this episode, write to a death row inmate with an execution date and tell them about it. I'm kidding, don't actually do that. Just tell your friends, family, and coworkers about it instead. Hopefully none of them are coming up for execution soon. Please leave me some ratings and reviews wherever you found me. Subscribe for more murder stories. Catch me live on Rumble and Odyssey on Thursday nights around 9:30 Mountain Time for recent crime news and probably some updates to this episode eventually. You can get me on Instagram and Twitter at LastMealPod. I'll be back next week to talk about a real fucking weird state that has policies I strongly disagree with. Gonna be a fun one for sure. I'm gonna close this one out with a quote from Shannon A. Thompson. No idea who she is. But the quote fits, so fuck it. Someone who doesn't know if tomorrow will come would rather live every day twice than live it once. See you next time.